Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
An article by W.H. Auden about the Quest Hero. How many of you all know have ever heard the name W.H. Auden? Have any of you?
I've heard it.
Yeah. Good. Good.
I don't know what it's from.
Yes,
I have heard it.
As of last night.
Pardon me? As of last night? Well, you know, that's education at work, hearing about it last night. W.H. Auden was one of the great poets of the 20th century. He died in probably the early 1990s or maybe late 80s. He's a great writer, a great poet. And he wrote criticism from time to time, but purely as an avocation, purely because he cared about something. He would write an article about it. And so this article is about the Quest Hero and also about Tolkien's Quest books. So it's pretty exciting to have a great poet like W.H. Auden writing a critical article. So we will discuss it, if not Tuesday, on Thursday. We'll definitely come back to both of these articles. So if you haven't read it, you're responsible for them. Go and make sure you read them carefully. Today, let's talk about Fellowship of the Ring. We're supposed to have finished two-thirds of it. We're going to continue a discussion we began the other day, but before I take us to that more directed discussion, let's just start by getting reactions. First of all, how many have read it before? Not everyone. I love reactions to reading it.
Was that about 12 out of 15 read it?
Something
before?
Like that. And I'd be curious if it seems different this time from when you read it as a child or if you just read it, but also just what you're thinking about it. Let's just start off there.
Yes. The beginning is less boring. Oh.
Peter,
The beginning is less boring than I remember it being.
Yeah, me too.
I think Bombadil is still as ridiculous as I remember.
Yeah. I can't believe he's in the movie.
Amen.
I never liked him, and I still don't like him. And I think now that I know more about him, his mere presence annoys me because he's the most irresponsible person ever to exist. So.
May I put you on hold unless you're going to talk about Bombadil, since he's laid down a challenge. I'm never going to let a gauntlet thrown like that onto the table go rest by itself. Yes.
As a first-time reader, I'd like to say that it's an exciting book, and like I've seen the movie a couple of times, so like when I'm reading, I can kind of follow along and be like, oh yeah, okay, and like, it helps me to understand the book a lot easier. Because I know when I'm reading, sometimes I have trouble picturing what's going on in the story.
We're going to be talking about that very issue of picturing things in stories. But I was hoping you were going to pick up the gauntlet about Bombadil. Come on, Wesley, talk about Bombadil.
I personally love Bombadil. One, because of his mystery. He's you don't know. They reveal just enough to say he's important. Just enough to say he's. I mean, he knows everything, but he's obviously powerful, but you just don't know what he's about, and you don't know where he's from and what he's doing. And I just love Bombadil. He's a cool savior. I don't know. I think he's very pure too. Like how the article was talking about how the hobbits just want to be happy and content, and not they don't need knowledge, they don't need power, they just want. Just want to live, and I think Bombadil's sort of like that. He is sort of akin to the hobbits, a little bit of an epitome, maybe.
Anybody got a response to that? That's a very thoughtful comment.
I was just saying, I really like Bombadil too, because I think he's just kind of cool. Because he's so like Wes said, he's like so powerful and whatever. But like you never hear about him again after the first book, really. And there's not really that much mention of him, I don't think, in any of other Tolkien's writings. So you don't really know what he's about. But he said he's been there since before everything else. Yeah. Not just everybody, but like everything, like before the hills and the mountains and stuff. So you gotta wonder what he is.
It's
almost like he's a god or some kind of like demigod.
He's a god. Well, like demigod's better than god.
Sauronish.
But his power does diminish at a certain point, so he's not perhaps a god.
Yeah.
He can't leave a certain space.
That's correct.
I did a little bit of reading, this was a long time ago, about Tolkien and his love for Bombadil. Like, initially, while he was writing The Fellowship, he wanted to write Tom as the protagonist of the sequel to The Hobbit. And he put him in there just in The Fellowship, even though he had the whole, you know, three-book arc already planned out, just because it was supposed to, like, represent something that would otherwise be absent from the entire trilogy. And that's just, like, the carefree, kind of, like, kiddish type novel or type character that was present all the time in The Hobbit.
Excellent. Other reactions? What kind of demigod is he?
I don't remember if he's mentioned in the Silmarillion or not, is he?
You know, this is not a course on Tolkien, but on the book.
But
so
just,
very few people have read the Silmarillion. More, perhaps, than can pronounce it.
They talk about Sauron and Balrogs and such in Silmarillion. So
right.
It has a lot to do with, you know, where things come from. So I didn't know if Bombadil came from there.
So what's he associated with?
Nature. Yeah.
He's a kind of pantheist.
He's kind of like the Force God Pan, right? But Pan's more mischievous, I guess. He's not like as good. Like Tom Bombadil is fundamentally a good person,
well,
it would seem, and Pan's not.
Right. Well, you will see Tom Bombadil and Goldberry and the Old Forest when you level a little higher. And all the stuff that you've missed from the movies will be there. I got to say, the Old Forest, they truly capture the fact that it's confusing. It is the hardest place to navigate in the entire game. And
without a doubt.
I've been there many times. And when you're low level and you're being attacked by trees and roots and spiders, it's really a nightmare. And it's just, you can feel what they must have felt like when you're. But even when you're a high level, and when you have a electronic map pulled up on your second screen, you still can't find your way through it. They do a great job of that. Seth, just back to the book, though. Tell me you wanted to react to the reading, right?
Well, when I first read it right before the movies came out, like 8th, 9th grade, I didn't know anything about how he like based his books off of, and then last year I learned that Tolkien was an Anglo-Saxon scholar and all stuff, and so I've read Beowulf and all that other stuff, so I can see the connections now, and it's just interesting how he formats it and his whole language and everything like that. So
you like that more?
I like it more now. I can just see much more in it than I did before.
Any more reactions? Anything you want to talk about?
I tried to read it like a few years ago. I just never got through it because when I was in, I guess, 6th grade, it was just very dull and boring. But I kind of like the movies, and I saw the movie again a few weeks ago, and then when I started reading the book, it's like the movie's good, but the book just blows it out of the water.
Okay.
Just because the way it, like I enjoy reading because I enjoy the environments they create and how lush it can do, and especially with Tolkien, he describes the atmosphere so well, which you cannot do in a movie. It's much harder to do in a movie than it is in a book. And especially when a well-written book can describe the atmosphere.
Daniel.
I was going to say, if you take playing the game, the things that you see in the game, the images you get in the game, and then the movie, and then you read about it, you get a better image, better understanding about everything that's going on. I think it helps me visualize a lot better than if I was just read the book or just see the movie or just play the game.
In fact, both of you all have touched on our discussion for today, and we'll be demonstrating some of that. It is pretty remarkable to play the game for a while and then read the book again, and suddenly, almost on a, not a sentence-by-sentence level, but frequently, every second or third page, I will come across something that I have seen and I suddenly have a different that I've seen in the game, and I suddenly have a different sense of the spatial relations and the geography of the imagination that Tolkien has constructed for us. And you know, we'll have to have a discussion about whose achievement this is. You know, is it Tolkien's imagination that should get all the credit for putting together that imaginary geography that the game just does a good job of making into a virtual world? We also want to think about the cinematic approach to space. That's what I want to talk about today, is the feeling of setting an environment, somebody used the word environment, so I'm picking up on that word, and space that each of these three different media give you. Book, movie, game. Let's try again to juxtapose three passages from the book, movie, and game. Today, open your book, get your book out, and open it. I know every single one of us is going to have a different page number, but open it to where Aragorn stumbles onto the stone trolls. That is Flight to the Ford.
What chapter is that?
Flight to the Ford, which is chapter 12. And then in my book, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 pages into chapter 4. Here's a way you can find, into chapter 12. Here's a way you can find it. It's maybe 3 or 4 pages before the long poem that Sam recites about trolls. You remember that poem?
I'm in like 227, 228. I'm not exactly sure.
So it's after the break that says, "In the morning he awoke to find that the rain had stopped."
Oh, yeah.
If you've got this, if you got like the movie version, it's page 228.
In the morning, he woke to find the rain and stuff.
Yeah.
What
is yours?
In the morning, he woke. So, I need to get.
I love that part of the movie too. And Lord of the Rings, sort of all in the background. Like, oh, whoa, trolls!
Did you just hear what Wesley said? He said, "I love the part in the movie where." They just sort of wake up, and it's, oh, whoa, trolls.
Yeah.
Right. I think I quoted him directly. Yeah. We'll have to review the tapes to see if I got it just right. Well, that's the scene I have queued up.
Wow.
So let us first go to room control, and did we decide scene 6 is the correct movie viewing?
Scene 5.
Scene 5 is even better.
Turn the
lights
off.
That's scene 5. I think scene 6. Okay, now let's go to DVD control. Now, please be ready to watch this because it's going to come on. And one of the things I just noticed when I was queuing it up before class is. It's a great montage shot of the face of the Uruk-hai warrior that Saruman has just created, standing like a statue, going like that, and it cuts from there straight to the face of a stone troll. Now, let's see if I've lost it. Yep, here it is. Shall we go back and just for the fun of it and see the Uruk-hai's face? There. Okay.
Mr. Bilbo's trolls. Mr. Frodo. He's going cold. Is he going to die?
He's passing into the shadow world. He'll soon become a wraith like them.
I think that's one of the best views of the trolls. And that's it, right? That's it in the movie.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah, what?
I didn't even notice the trolls in the movie. Okay.
Well, did you notice them in the book?
Yes.
Had you read The Hobbit?
Yes, I remember that part.
I mean,
that's
it's
what he's
a,
talking about.
It's a pretty powerful connection back with The Hobbit, isn't it? Has anyone not read The Hobbit? How many have not read The Hobbit?
I haven't read The Hobbit in so long.
Years.
Yeah,
like 10
yeah.
years.
I was not
somebody that's got it fresh in their mind, tell the story of The Hobbit.
Not
of the whole Hobbit, but of the
troll
scene. Yes, yes.
Well, I don't remember how the trolls got there, how they found Bilbo, but they were contemplating how they were going to eat him and how they were like, who was going to get him first, and then the sun came up and turned them all to stone.
They were arguing. Right?
Yeah, they were arguing about something.
Yeah. Is he in the saddle or something?
What kind of scene is that? Have you seen those kind of scenes in
comic relief?
Well, probably comic relief, definitely.
Irony.
But I was thinking more like just fairy tale.
Right.
Haven't you seen that in 100 fairy tales where they're sitting around, or one way to get out of being eaten is to get them to debate about who gets the best bite or whatever. So it is Tolkien using a fairy tale motif in The Hobbit. How does it work when you've read The Hobbit to have them re-encounter it like this?
It's almost like an Easter egg. You know what I mean?
No, I don't.
It's like one of those hidden things. Like an Easter egg is like a little, like usually it's like a little in-game joke that a developer might leave behind in a game. Like, it's not the best definition of it, but that's kind of like...
Oh, an Easter egg in a game, not in real life.
Yeah. So like if you hadn't read The Hobbit, you might not understand why the trolls were in this movie. But.
Yes, it is like an Easter egg in that sense.
Like if you ever been to homestarrunner.com, those things are full of Easter eggs.
Or like if
other reactions
game
to
has
it.
Like X, Y, Z, Z, Y, is it?
Oh, yeah.
Just in the code somewhere, then it's an Easter egg with Zork.
Plug. Very well. Is it plug?
Okay. You remember, they've been at Weathertop, right there. You see it on this Tolkien map. Professor Hall found this map. Where'd you find this map? Just I know on the internet.
It's hard to say.
It's a very nice map.
I've
it's clearly
got it on my Flickr account now, so
it's clearly Tolkien's map. Blown up. They came down from Weathertop and hit the road. They crossed the last bridge. You'll see all of these in the game, and they go into the troll shops, and there, right there.
Very spot.
That very spot, that arrow marks the spot where the trolls are. And here's the fort of Brunnen and Rivendell. So, talk about the effect, besides of it being an Easter egg, of encountering the trolls in this scenario. Yeah.
Well, I feel like it's kind of a maturation of, you know, from The Hobbit, like I was saying earlier, is kind of like a kid's book.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're encountering these trolls in the Fellowship, it's a dire situation. So, like, it's very, like, real and serious.
Yeah, and that Matt's point's nice. In The Hobbit, it's comic relief. Here, it's something else. He's about to die there. The fairy tale tone of the let's trick him into having an argument over who gets to eat who is now changed into a different kind of realism. There is a maturation. What else? What other effect is there to it in terms of... Yes, what's it?
I think it really brings the world together. You know, it brings another really strong connection between, you know, Bilbo's footsteps and Frodo's footsteps. And they're both making, you know, they're both got their own quest, they're both on their journey, and they've sort of come together and mirror each other.
Last week we talked about time. How does this affect your sense of time? Because this is following on what you said, bringing the books together. How does it affect your sense of time?
long time's passed.
Yeah.
Time has passed.
There's a bird's nest behind the trolls here in the book.
There is. And, you know, those old frozen trolls, there's a bird's nest behind their the ear. There's a kind of it gives us, doesn't it add to a sense of historical continuity? How does it affect your sense of the persistence of the world? In gaming, we talk about persistent world games. That is, this LOTRO is a persistent world because each time you go back, you're in the same place where you left your character. Some persistent world games allow you to build objects into the game that then are there for other characters. LOTRO says they're going to let you build, have houses in the fall, so I hope they do, so that you can build a house and it will then be in the world of the game. What about fiction having a persistent world?
Well, it helps immerse you in the either the imaginary world or dream world or whatever kind of setting they're trying to set up.
If you've read The Hobbit, you go, oh, wow, Hobbit. The trolls saying, yeah. And suddenly kind of hyperlinked to read backwards from computer technology to book technology, suddenly hyperlinked in the book is a reference to a much earlier historical passage.
Wikipedia.
Like in Wikipedia, yes. You've got a hyperlink back to The Hobbit from here. Any other thoughts about that?
I think it also sort of adds to the... It makes the world feel more real because, I mean, right now they're just sort of... They're not going in a straight line, but it's kind of hard to imagine them sort of in the middle of the wilderness. It's there. They're at Weathertop. They're going to Rivendell. Everyone's like, well, we can go north, but that's not a good choice. So we can go this way, but we'll run out of food. So we have to cross this ford. But you're like, okay, so now they're going to go from here to the ford to Rivendell. So sort of like a straight line. But I feel like the trolls bring up a sort of... he never really talks about trolls. The trolls are in The Hobbit a little bit, and they're here a little bit. But trolls... I mean, there's a cave troll in Moria. Yeah, so trolls come up, but he sort of puts a little bit about trolls in there. So you're thinking, well, there are trolls in this world, and there's a lot about trolls I don't know. So I think it sort of brings out that there's a lot of things about his world that you don't know. You can look at the map, and you're like, none of this is going to be explained in the book. This is just a small portion of this huge world. I don't know, that's the feeling I get from the trolls.
That's not where I want to be. Now, if I swap my... If I hit one, I'm changing our... We now have all three projectors going, and we have the Lord of the Rings...
Jay, you have to plug yours.
Oh, okay, got to plug this in.
We don't have wireless video yet.
No.
Oh, yeah. Someday, maybe.
Someday.
Wireless power.
I want to get in between the wireless power and the wireless video.
Okay,
yeah,
so...
Wireless is
wireless is better. Okay.
So now I would go to...
You're fine. You just need to get your laptop synced up. You're trying to source it at the top? Wherever you did before, bring it back to the table.
Is RGB2 going to be the correct source routing?
That's
all
right.
Next
week.
So,
yeah, so it's fine. So you need to just flip your control on your laptop to output. You've got it in the right spot. You just have to get your laptop output into your external. Looks like it's coming up. There you go. Right.
Sometimes it doesn't like it when you plug in your output after your computer is already going. So let's give it a second.
My Mac doesn't mind.
There we are. Well, except I can't see it. I can't see my
Seth. He's over there hitting off on those legs.
He could. He might be able to up the.
So low tech.
One more time.
You can probably up the gamma under options of the game.
Flip screen.
Gamma's like the brightness.
Of course, I could navigate off the big screen rather than off of my computer. So we'll get it one more second. But we're doing it. Now that we've got the lights all down, let's read. here we got everything. But I just want you, Cherubel is standing in the Trollshaws, which in-game, let me show you the in-game map. This is a very slow computer. Sorry, it'll take a minute. In-game, you can see where Cherubel is standing. There's Trollshaws on that map, Tolkien's map. You see Trollshaws is this entire region for questing. This region will be, don't anybody look at any of these locations, because for you, they'll all be blanked out, and it would be getting a head start to see where all the landscape features. This red dot there is Cherubel. So they've crossed the last bridge right there. They've turned left and gone north. And they've gone too far north. And where I have Cherubel standing is too far north. And in the book, it says, when he returned, he was not reassuring. We have come too far to the north, he said, and we must find some way to turn back southwards again. If we keep on as we are going, we shall get up into Ettendales, far north of Rivendell. Well, let's see here. Yes, here are the Trollshaws. There's Ettenmoors.
Can they call it Ettendales in the book?
They do, but then a little bit later, I think they also call it Etten.
What is Ettenmoors?
It is, in fact, the PvP region of Lord of the Rings online. So that when you reach level 10, you can go play as a monster in Ettenmoors as a level 50 monster. Or when you actually get your character to 40, you can go play as yourself in the PvP region. But then, of course, you're going to encounter a lot of level 10s with their level 50 monsters trying to kill you. So it's a dangerous place to go. So we've got Gilkarek and Hutt and Phaedrus talking to us there.
Is that a troll, correct?
That is a troll.
Yeah, can we watch the troll die?
What?
Can you kill the troll?
I can kill the troll.
Do it.
Oh, come on. You guys are bloodthirsty. I keep saying...
Wait. Can't you just talk to the troll?
Try diplomacy.
I would like to reason with that troll.
Try diplomacy first. This is right.
Slash waves.
Look, it's a miserable little 40 troll.
But he's got twice your HP.
Slash hug.
Yeah.
Slash
hug.
Okay. I don't think you can kill him.
Oh, the troll! Oh,
I gave him a big hug. So there he is. There's a troll. You notice my low connection. That tree there means I don't have a lot it's dimming down some of the resolution so that you can see it move. I don't want to really get into a fight with these trolls at this moment. It would be too mean to them.
Yeah, wait.
Okay, so it's nighttime. So we've gone too far north. Let's see here. If you notice, my map up here, that's my direction arrow. Cherubel's facing north. They were headed along this path down there, and they turned east to go along that path, like this. There's a troll. You want me to kill these trolls?
Yeah, let's see what you got.
It would take a long time to kill such a...
Are they not aggressive?
They're pretty active.
They're unbelievably aggressive, but they know they've met their match. they're gray to me, for heaven's sakes. That's like picking on a little kid.
As you try and shoot his eyes.
Okay.
Can you stab him in the back?
Why not?
Couldn't resist the combat.
Couldn't resist a little combat.
I'm still working on it.
Uh-oh, Rock.
Hey, while you're observing the fight, think about this. How long did it take to complete in the Auden Quest Hero discussion you're going to read when you get back to the reserve and the library? How long did it take for the whole Lord of the Rings story to take place? How many days?
80 days.
How many miles? You remember how many miles?
1,800.
1,800 miles.
Was it leagues?
I think this goes to Professor Clayton's point about compressing time and distance.
But I stunned him back. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
It's too exciting with the stunning and the combat. And for those in the listening audience, we're having a great combat fest here against a troll.
While Professor Hall is actually making a substantive point.
Yes, which occasionally happens. So think about the time it takes you to go from the Shire to the Prancing Pony in-game. How long does it take you? If in real time, how long do you think just to take a walk from the Shire to Bree and the Prancing Pony?
It takes a while. Yeah, like not 20 days.
Well, Matt, I heard Matt say 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Yeah,
that sounds good. Probably 15, if you were to walk 20, it, if you were to hoof it, just take the full journey, maybe 20 minutes. How long would it take to go from, in this, look at the Tolkien map, look where Bree is, look where the Shire is, and let's, can you get that off magnify for me, please, Professor?
Yeah, I sure can.
Make sure you don't. I'm sure he'll die.
Don't die.
Oh, you're not going to die? Come on.
I did put
he's
that
in dire danger.
Look how much defense he has. Look at that.
I'm a guardian.
That's right, you are.
Mm-hmm. Look at that. Oh. Now I'm going to loot that sucker.
No loot.
So look at the mile scale, guys, here. I know this is not as exciting as combat in Middle-earth. Mile scale. 200.
Okay. 200 miles.
Take a mile... Chris, go measure the distance between the Hobbiton and Bree and give us a miles estimate up there.
Where?
Hobbiton's right near your finger. There's Bree. Nope, way too far.
Left.
There.
Bingo. Which is a form of bingo. 125,
150. So, since you're all math majors and econ majors, this should be easy. 125 miles in 20 minutes. What's your miles per hour?
Very fast.
Like 200 miles an hour? Almost. Something like that.
So our little characters, compressing time and distance, are
zipping.
They're zipping.
Right.
Well, you see how fast
I can say 160 miles per hour.
It's pretty fast.
Maybe the horses are like 700.
Those horses are really cranky.
Yeah, but this is without my horse, which I'm getting on right here to demonstrate that I could be faster
summon
if I
horse.
Wanted to. Yeah. Yes, they do.
Okay. Of course he has one.
They need to add some epic flying.
Can you fight while on the horse?
You may not.
Oh, man.
So do they have this thing?
That would be so cool. Like in WoW,
you'd be like a hunter on the horse.
Flying out.
You
want
to cancel? Log out.
You abandoned your horse.
You sleep there.
Okay. So,
back to
our geography, our spatial sense. When you come into this area at Trollshaw's as a character off that road, it is the second most confusing place in the game. Natural place, not you know, dungeon, but the second most confusing natural landscape in the game after the Old Forest, just like it is in the book. But now I was lost. I turned east, and then a little, did it say a little southeast?
But keep on as we were going. That is troll country. Get up in the Ettendale's far north of Rivendell. That's troll country.
Yeah. The maps don't correlate perfectly between the game and the fiction, do they? Because it seems like sometimes the spacing is off.
They found a passage between two hills that led them into a valley running southeast. Is that what you're looking for?
Yep. Into a valley running southeast.
The direction that they wished to take, but towards that end of the day, I don't see more directionals there. So, running southeast.
I've got myself a lot. My lag is so bad on this slow computer that I've got myself a little lost here.
Okay.
Now I'm headed south. Let's hope I'm still going the right direction.
But it raises the issue of representing a fictional space that was described in prose, represented by Tolkien in this map, into a game space with compressed distance that allows people and their players to go 320 miles an hour, right?
And in a movie, which allows a jump cut, a montage, from a face of the Uruk-hai to already there with the troll. Before we go any further, read how they found those, they encountered the trolls. Skip a page or two farther.
Where are we?
There are trolls, Pippin panted. Is that what you're looking for?
Yes. What? Where is that?
Well, I'm in my big book here. It's.
But how many?
Start. If you can find. As soon as they had eaten, they set out again.
That's
they
right.
Leap, go down to the end of that paragraph set.
Okay, read that to us, will you?
I'll read right the last sentence in the paragraph above it. But they had not gone very far before Pippin came back running, followed by Merry. They both looked terrified. There are trolls, Pippin panted. Down in the clearing in the woods, not far below, we got a sight of them through the tree trunks. They are very large. We will come and look at them, said Strider, picking up a stick. Frodo said nothing, but Sam looked scared. Strider's going to whoop him with a stick.
And so, there you have, in the movie, all you had was Sam saying, oh, look at the trolls, Mr. Frodo.
Did you find it?
We'll see if I did. It's a very confusing place. I may have turned around and gone back where I...
It looks like you don't get aggro.
No, you don't get aggro.
You know, to compare this to Star Wars Galaxies, how many of you know Star Wars or seen the first movies? Anyone?
I've seen Star Wars.
Okay, I've seen Star Wars. It's a question I'm going to ask. We got 100%. How many have played Star Wars Galaxies, the MMO? Anyone? Professor Clayton and I. They have something in Star Wars Galaxies called POIs, points of interest, where you would get credit for visiting the fictional places in the movie. So you would go to Obi-Wan Kenobi's house.
Or the Mos Eisley Cantina.
You would go to the Mos Eisley Cantina was a POI. This would have, by analogy, been a POI here in Chris.
I don't know if they get experience points for everything, but in this other game called Vanguard, you get points just for exploring new pieces of territory. Like there,
you can see this is a POI in this game because look right there, the Stone Trolls Glade, and then because I found it, the little flag appears that is the Stone Trolls
Glade. Many games have that convention.
Glade.
I like those flags.
Right, and there it is.
Beautiful.
And this is not easy to find. So that let's talk about what that does to your spatial sense.
In which form of media?
I'm going to bring the lights back up so we can have a conversation here. Okay. Question I want to ask is, what does each of the three media have to immerse you in a spatial but fictional world? It's an abstract question, but let's see. And I'm going to type your answers up here as you make them.
Mm-hmm.
talked about time once before. And as you saw, we said novels have a complex relation to reading time. Novels have the ability to have flashbacks and foreshadowing. We said pacing can be fast or slow. In films, we said there's a very finite relation to viewing time unless you're watching it on a DVD and choose to stop it and intervene in the process. And, of course, a movie can do flashbacks and the movie has control of pacing. In games, we said there's a really disproportionate relation between story time and playing time. You put in months of playing time to get in a little bit of story. Flashbacks, only in the cutscenes. Now, I imagine everyone can think of an exception to that. And Mike has. You want to tell us? I don't want to
say. Well, I was just going to say, has anyone ever played, like, X-Men Legends?
No.
It's just like that. The flashbacks are playable, like their missions.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of a fun game.
Well, you that know, actually, game. there are missions instances that in the epic books that will send you back into scenes from the novel. So there are playable flashbacks. So.
In some of the Lord of the Rings games too for console, there were flashbacks that were playable.
Yeah. Okay, so, and playable missions. Okay, and one pace throughout. I'm talking about one pace, which is your pace. You know, how fast you move your character through an event is the pace. So there can, of course, be multiple paces. You can slow down and just look at the scenery for a long, long time. But the author doesn't have control of the pace. So really, you could just say one pace throughout, I think. Have I formulated that correctly? Mm-hmm. So let's try to do the same thing for our sense of the spatial worlds that novels give. Novels. Setting or spatial orientation. Okay, it's up to you now. What do you get in novels?
What the author wants you to see.
Right.
Because he will outline it with the parameters of his words.
Okay, and how does he achieve that effect?
Prose?
Right. That is very important. I mean, it is something we're going to talk about in another session. Is medium? If I can get my fingers on this medium, you've already supplied us the answer to the medium, which is prose, right there. But going back to that, how does an author create a setting?
Yeah, he paints a picture of the world around the people first,
mm-hmm.
and then he places them there, which would be different from, like, a movie. I mean, sometimes it'll they just did with the going from the face to the ogre or the troll's face. You know, it'll have it zoomed in on a character, and then it'll zoom out on the world that they've created.
That's very thoughtful. I'm not exactly sure how to encapsulate that insight onto our board. Maybe.
It's okay.
Yes.
Well,
I think Matt had his hand up before you did, Mike.
I was just going to say it's all in how you take in the setting. Like, novels, it's your imagination. With movies, you can't change the setting. You can't make small adjustments because it's set there for you. You're looking at it, you're using your eyes. And then with the game, you're using your avatar, and so you can change it. So.
Yeah.
It's your mind, no ability to change, and then your eyes, your ability to look around through games.
You can't look around the corner in the movie, but you can.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You don't have, like, any ability to do that. But it's also the easiest to follow the movie.
So did I capture that by saying perspective determined by camera angle versus you get to control perspective?
Yeah. Took the words from my mouth.
Take a look. I mean, here I am, I'm looking. Here's Chirrible. You can see him in the DVD screen over there. Here's Chirrible staring at the feet, and I can take my camera up, twirl it around like that, and suddenly I'm looking at the rear end of a troll, of a stone troll. And then I can decide to run around it and look at it. You know, it's a little bit more like being in a museum, walking around a statue, since these are like statues. So I mean, it's fairly elementary, but eventually through our discussions, we're going to start to get an entire census of the different artistic tools available in these media. Greg?
I was just wondering, during the daytime in game here, are there no trolls?
There are plenty of trolls in game time, which is a flaw.
Well, is it dark?
It's
very dark.
It's dark right now, but you're right. It's a discrepancy between Tolkien's imaginary world and Lotro's. They want those trolls around there throwing rocks at you whenever you go on your quests, because there's lots of little quests set into the troll shaws, and you have to know about it.
Well, that's a necessary change. Right. You wouldn't want like nothing in there during the day.
Well, they've got lots of other dangerous stuff in there.
There are night day quests that are night day sensitive.
There sure are. So,
Daniel, what were you going to say?
I would say that I'd rather have some sort of like in the game, some sort of like thick trees to where light couldn't get in there somehow during the day, so that it stays true to the Tolkien.
What would be the virtue of it being true to Tolkien? And let me broaden that out by asking, when you see a movie that deviates from the book, is that always a flaw?
Depends what they're trying to accomplish.
We're having a good discussion, but some people aren't participating.
The movies.
If you haven't participated yet, I want you to make a comment before the class is over. Okay? Go ahead.
The movie is not the author's work. It's just, I feel like it's supposed to represent, but they still have the freedom to change it around.
Mm-hmm. Well, movies, a lot of times they change it just like take out the boring parts that, with the quotations around it, because it's not always boring in the book, but like watching them walk forever would not be like an exciting thing in the movie, so they kind of like skip through the action parts.
Or montage.
They have to compress the passage of time, because they only have 2 hours, you know, 2 to 3 hours, but it's very clear that, like a stage drama, it's a finite relation to viewing time, which means that they have to change things in the narrative to compress it into their time span. Yes,
man. And I'd argue the same exact thing for gaming, because if I knew that I had to walk or grind for 2 hours in between every quest, it would definitely be a different game. And I wouldn't play it.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you would. Well, maybe it would be a class. But
you're required.
You grind for months to get one little thing.
But it's not... Okay, maybe we're talking about marginal costs here, but... I'm just saying...
Econ major.
Diminishing marginal return to scale.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, but... In reading, like we talked about in the first part, there's a good chunk of 50 pages there where they're not doing anything. And I guarantee you in the game, if we're going by the book, there wouldn't be a 5, 6, 7 hour gameplay that would be like that, because they'd lose so many people. So you do have parameters.
Is that a problem with people or with... I mean, could you imagine a game that would appeal to a different set of gamers that would not have a lot of action in it?
It wouldn't sell enough.
Yes, I know.
Well, Myst is kind of like that, though, right?
Myst,
there's no combat
like
in
that.
Myst, I don't
know. No combat.
The Sims.
No.
The game's
Sims?
I love the Sims.
So, in other words, I'm saying, is it a implicit feature of the game, or is it a feature of their marketing strategy to reach the widest possible group, as you said, Jeff, that in that widest possible group right now happens to be 14-year-old males. Tim had his hand up first, and I really want to come back to
I'm sort of going back to the whole movie from the book. I think what happens with that is the director, when he makes the movie, it's his interpretation of the book. And when you read a book, everyone interprets it differently. So I think what happens is, I don't know if this, has an author ever written a book and then directed the movie on it, just out of curiosity?
Yes. Yes, it has.
Because when that happens, I imagine that the movie comes off very close to what, like, the average interpretation of the book.
Not always, you know, because the author can be a bad director. And in fact, it takes an amazingly skilled director to achieve that verisimilitude to the book. That's a real work, act of art. Jonathan had his hand up before you go.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that gaming is by definition entertaining, and like that's why the makers of like the game designers, they try to make, try to skip through the boring parts to make it as entertaining as possible.
Yeah.
So, I would become more of like a simulation game if they started making time and, you know, and
80 days.
I was gonna say something else.
80 days to get from
the
shower to Rivendell.
Simulating. All right, let's simulate this event exactly like.
And it wouldn't be marketless.
Yeah, and that also goes back to the whole, like, I want to level up thing. Like,
but it's possible, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we got to distinguish between constraints that are inherent in the formal medium. You know, constraints that they could not overcome because of the nature of the medium. Like, you couldn't have moving graphics in a print novel. You know, that's a constraint. You couldn't have music playing out of the print. You could, you know, you could package a CD along with it, but you couldn't have. That's a constraint built into the genre, into the mode, as opposed to constraints that they're making a business decision about.
Well, people play with time. One of your favorite shows is an innovation on time on television. Kiefer Sutherland.
Me four.
This would go to what Matt Shelton wants.
Yeah, there's your
80-day quest. Right?
Your 80-day quest.
Who would have
24?
Thought you would have 24 hours for the show? Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing innovation.
Craig?
Yeah. I was just going to go back to what Tim said. It seems to work most often in a book-to-movie situation when authors don't actually act as directors but sign off on things that happen, like Frank Miller with 300 and Sin City. Those are basically direct, like, adaptations of the books into movies.
That's a really good point, and you've used the correct word for it. In literary studies, there's now a field called adaptation studies, which is all about the very special relations that can obtain between two works that are adapted from different media. So, Max, I'm going to be listening for you pretty close soon, so keep focused here on your upcoming comment. Will, that would be you too. Ted, did you have your hand up? Did I get to you?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. Back to spatial setting or spatial orientation. How does a novel achieve it? We've said a few little things. Well, Tim, is it time for you to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck on your test.
Good luck.
Yeah. Mike.
Well, sometimes they have maps in the book, like in The Fellowship of the Ring, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. In fact, we've been looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
So we got map as a spatialization technique. You have a map in a movie?
Yeah, sometimes they'll start it off, like often they'll start off with it and like zoom in.
I would say rarely.
No, sometimes they do though. I mean,
sometimes.
Or like they'll show it like during a journey, like they'll show a little line going from one spot to another.
During like a montage sort of.
Yeah, is that regarded as
a terrible movie?
Do you feel like that is the most sophisticated cinematic moment when they cut to a map and then you have
a critical hit?
Well, we're not saying whether it's sophisticated or not. We're saying, does it exist? And it
yeah,
does.
But in other words, you can get clunky things imported from one medium into another, and they feel clunky because they don't work that as well in that medium. Yes.
I agree when you say that, you know, much of perspective in a movie is based on, like, the camera angle and exactly what you can see. But I think, like, unlike a game, a movie as well as a book, like, they're expecting you to, like, think about what's around and not just the camera angle. And it's more than just what you're seeing at that point in time. It's about the entire setting around what's going on.
Okay, but that's a special... I'm not quite yet sure how to put it up on the board, but that is a special phenomenon of, I think, all art, isn't it? That...
But in a game, it's...
It gives... Well, except games. You've got a comment, Max?
Well, to elaborate, it's sort of like the degree of freedom sort of thing. Like, in books, you use a lot of imagination, in movies a little bit less, and in games, I mean, you can do whatever you want. You know, in games like this.
In a game. I mean, I'm trying to write down Will and Max's comment, because I think those are good ones. In a novel, you have an implicit world sense. Is that
sense of place?
Sense of place, guided by the
writer.
Yeah, the writing. And that is a very interesting thing that narrative does. That is a trait of narrative, that it gives you this implicit sense that there's more to the world than the author's put on the page. If the author had to describe every single word of a setting, that would not be an engaging novel. You've had your hand up patiently, yeah. Peter, I apologize.
I guess, I don't know if it's really, it's sort of upsetting. I think in games and films, music adds to it. It doesn't really show you the spatial, but it kind of adds to the feeling of the room.
When you're in a forest, isn't there pretty typical forest-like music?
Yeah.
That you hear in tons of movies and tons of video games.
Okay,
so,
atmospheric music?
I think
creating a spatial sense, that's quite paradoxical, isn't it? Isn't that paradoxical, that one sense can be used to create something you associate with another sense? But of course, space is an auditory. It's primarily for those of us that are sighted. It is primarily a visual sense, but it also has an auditory dimension. You know, somebody's closer to you or farther behind because of your ears.
But can I plant one thing from the audience, the quest hero, that I want you to pay attention to? When they talk about setting, the opening paragraph in the setting starts, many quest tales are set in a dreamland. That is to say, no definite place or time. This has the advantage of allowing the use of all the wealth of dream imagery, monsters, transformation, and translation. This is a mental space we're experiencing all of these things in.
Yes, sir, Matt.
Illustrations for novels.
And isn't that interesting? Illustrations
2D
are kind of a primitive attempt to get a graphic dimension into a codex print technology. And if you're a scholar of 19th century literature or a reader of 19th century literature like I am, those were books where almost all novels had a few illustrations. But it would only be a few. You know, one every third or fourth chapter. Whereas, you know, film is... It's a moving picture. Yes, Seth.
Movies more have... Their setting is more familiar to us. City settings or in the country.
Uh-huh.
And we have games and literature, they can be in more diverse areas, because if you're not familiar with the set, like, you don't see many love stories on the moon type of thing. And so I just
the
like
the first movie, one of the very first movies ever made, was called Journey to the Moon.
There they shot the rocket into the face
of the moon. And actually, I think, you know, you happen to see more movies shot in a realistic world, but there's nothing intrinsic about realism to the movie.
I think that's probably our generation.
Uh-huh.
It's expensive. Or it used to be more expensive.
Right.
Yes. And I think within games, especially MMORPGs, like in the beginning of the game when you first load it, they describe the setting in like a movie. Like, I know in WoW they have it, but I think they also have it in Lojo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like they say between Azeroth and Kalimdor, and they describe a story in the beginning.
Yes.
When you first open the game for the first time.
May I draw your attention to the fact that atmospheric music plays a huge role in the sense of place in most games, and especially Outro. There's regions you go into and you know, better be careful because of the music. Professor Ollie, you look like you're bursting with something. Okay, Ted.
I feel like in movies and games that it's a lot easier to like kind of differentiate between, well, obviously it's easier to differentiate between night and day because like they'll shoot a scene in the nighttime. Like when I'm reading a book, a lot of the times I picture the scene happening during the day in the light.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it says it happens at night, like sometimes like I'll forget as I keep reading that it happens, it's happening at night, and like I'll go back to like my whole picturing it as during the day, and that kind of changes the mood of the reading a bit. If you so like just the differences between the mood.
I don't know, him just saying that reminded me of in fourth grade, the Chinese teacher came and read us a story, some traditional Chinese story, and in the story it was raining, and like after she was done reading the story, I looked out the window and realized it was sunny outside. I was completely surprised, and I think it's because in books, I almost get to the point where I can feel that it is raining, like I can feel what the characters are feeling, whereas in the movie, I think the music really helps with that, the sound and the bass, you know, when you hear the troll stomp, you sort of, you feel the stomp because the sound's reverberating, but
yeah.
In the book you can sort of, I don't know, certain atmospheres, you can feel them in your mind.
You couldn't tell when I was fighting that troll because my connection's so bad, but that troll stomps and you everything shakes. I mean, it is really something, and it's the sound and yes.
Sounds plays a part in a novel, though. I mean, obviously you don't hear it, but they'll often say, like, there's some kind of music in the background, or, like, with the elves, there's usually some kind of singing going on, or some kind of music playing.
Well,
so,
you know,
I mean, I don't think
they
you
have
can...
to say it.
Yeah, but, I mean, you can still imagine it. Like, it sets the backdrop for whatever's taking place.
You you turn the page here from the passage Professor Hall was just reading to us, and you've got Sam singing a long song. And, you know, that illustrates your point. And yet I heard murmurings that the poem was almost not boring, or comments like that when we turned to it. I think the imagination has to play a different kind of role to get music into the medium.
But whenever you're reading a book, you are story motivated. You want to know what's going to happen. And whenever you get to a part that's enriching, like a you know the it's like the song is enriching and it helps you develop Sam's character,
mm-hmm.
but you really want to know what's going to happen next. That's why I find it boring, is because I don't want to read this. I want to know what's happening.
So we haven't gotten. Well, never mind. Yes, Matt.
Oh no, it's just funny.
Okay. You know, no one has said the most basic technique for creating a setting.
For which one?
In a novel. The number one most basic tool at the novel's disposal
description.
Stereotypes? Is description.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Imagery.
Prose is description?
Just say that.
Imagery. Well, that's
okay, I didn't
imagery.
Understand your term.
Is it imagery description?
Maybe. Yes,
yeah.
I mean, maybe. Though imagery could also mean, to some people...
stereotypes.
Very poetic images. Figures rather than prosaic descriptions. So I was going to have those be two different things. I see people are packing up. That clock is fast, but I think we have had a pretty decent discussion on this topic and can call it a day. Unless you have something to say.
Some things, definitions and words. Imagery, if I ask any six of you, you may give me 10 answers. Here in my dictionary of literary terms, imagery is a general term, covers the use of language to represent objects, actions, feelings, thoughts. There's 7 or 8 pages on what imagery is. So finding a common sense definition of these terms for each of us is not going to be easy, Matt. So we have to continue to explore. That's the purpose of the dialogue.